It's the English Martial Arts Podcast Show.
How you doing? The Habbo radio station everyone loves.
I love them a lot.
Hello and welcome to the English Martial Arts Podcast Show. And in this episode, we have an interview with Anders Linnard, who is a longsword specialist and a competitor in HEMA tournaments. He is also a traditionalist when it comes to HEMA as well, and studies the manuscripts and manuals very deeply, and is a thinker about what things used to be like for the people who actually used these arts to survive with and go to war with. So, without any more waffling, here is the interview with Anders Linnard. How did you first get involved with HEMA?
That's like everyone who I've ever spoken to in HEMA, they were a bit like they started with swords as kids, and then they never really stopped. I think it was like this sort of dream, you know, as a kid that I just continued to have. And I did sport fencing for a bit when I was in my early teens, and when I was like 18, I started with these. I did role-playing games and LARP and stuff like that in my teens as well. And then when I was around 18, I joined the Society of Creative Anachronism, and I did some fighting there for a year or so. And there I actually met a guy who did some sort of prototype of HEMA. So he actually did look at the old sources for rapier fencing and so on, and he started a club here in Gothenburg called Sjödesal. Okay. And that was active for like 2 years, so this was mid-90s or so. Okay. That club got sort of, they stopped training, I think, and then a few years later, the online community grew, and I got together with some friends and I trained a bit on myself, and then we got together and I started GHFS in 2003.
Right. So what were your main sources that you studied at the time?
The manuscript that's called Dobringer, mostly, and then but primarily Ringek. Right. And David Lindholm, Swedish guy, did a translation in, I don't know, 2002 maybe, and so we used that one. Now we work off a translation made by Andreas Engström in GHFS instead, but it's still my main source, although I look at everything, of course.
Of course, yeah. So you went from being interested in swords as a kid through the SCA into HEMA, and then you started a HEMA sporting career.
Yeah, well, you know, for me it was never for me HEMA it's experimental, right? So one of the things with competing for me was we had an online community, and to be frank, a lot of us are nerds at heart, and there was a lot of talk, a lot of people who had a lot of like a good reputation, but you didn't actually know if they could fence. Do these guys know how to fight?
Yeah.
So in that sort of pursuit of knowledge and things, it was a lot of people got very technical and academic about it, and that's all good and well. But there is also a reality of you know, just your physical ability to perform these techniques. So for me, the sport became that sort of outlet of that thing, and get people to train harder and work harder and measure themselves against opponents that also want to win, and often against opponents that you've never you don't know who they are. You can't really prepare for the specific opponent. You prepare for fighting at a tournament, maybe.
Yes.
You do that by studying the sources and training harder. So it was a way of getting rid of some of the internet bravado, I think, in favor of physical ability and that sort of thing.
Okay. So the actual sporting part of HEMA for you was just to practice and see if the stuff you were learning worked.
Yeah, and I've tried to stay true to that as far as it's possible. I mean, there are limitations to the sport and the competitions as well. Like they're not they've never been like the my main focus really. My main focus has always been training and the study in general, but it's like one outlet of what you do.
Right.
And I think it's a really important one. But for me, HEMA is also bigger that you do sport, the sport part for a section in your life and in your HEMA career, but there's a before and there's an after that as well, I think. And it's important to remember that we shouldn't get too focused on just the sporting aspect. I think everyone agrees with it, basically.
Yeah, I mean, there are a few clubs I know that do concentrate on the sporting side of it rather than the martial side of it, but not as many as I think in the HEMA community that try and study it for the martial arts side of it. You know, the study of manuals and manuscripts so that their interpretations fit what they think they were doing at the time, which is a good thing, I think.
Yeah. So I know that Mike Edelson in the US, when it comes to the martial aspects, he's also, you know, written and talked a bit about that, how you can change your training to you know, be more sort of situationally aware. You can throw in you know, things from the side and fence with carrying the sword, you know, in a scabbard and you know, do things that are sort of that you don't get in a competition.
You know,
train it more like a military or police a policeman would train handling a firearm.
Yeah.
In modern training.
That's a good idea. A very good idea.
Yeah.
So, Anders, what do you think of the HEMA scene at the moment? Is it healthy, or are there things you would like to see different within it?
I don't know. I relate less and less to the HEMA scene. Like, we've always been an online community, since the late 90s at least, we've been an online community. And it has its sort of pros and cons. You know, it lets you connect to people from all over the world, but it's also a bad thing. Like I've started sort of getting rid of people who have a negative impact, I think, in my personal life.
Right. Okay.
You know, just filter them out and listen to, like, even like, it's not people who I disagree with, like, I mean, that I sort of get rid of in my online but community, but it's people who are negative in their sort of view of how to relate to other people, and that's a negative aspect of the HEMA community. But I think that we're growing, and we're growing quickly. It's we're going from a community where you basically know all the movers and shakers to a community where all of a sudden you have people living basically next door that you don't really, you know, they're great men, but you can't sort of you don't really have the overview anymore of the entire community, and that's natural. I think it's hard to say one thing that it's like this now. There's a lot of things going on, but for me personally, I don't feel as connected to to all of HEMA like HEMA was one thing anymore.
No. I mean, I found within HEMA there are a lot of different sort of aspects of it. You have people who concentrate on bringing it back as a martial art, you know, the unarmed side, the pugilism, the wrestling ring geek and all that. Then you have people who purely love the sporting side of it, and you have people who like to talk about it, the, you know, the manuscripts and that, and then they do a bit of practice. But so, I mean, I suppose there's room for all kinds of practitioners. It doesn't just have to be people who train really hard and want to fight all the time.
And I think also that if you truly like if this sort of is your lifestyle, there's not one of these or two of these. It's all of these things that you have to explore, and maybe you do it at one point, like you go through a sporting part of your you know, HEMA career, or then you stop and you focus on something else. Like there's or some you know, for you go back and forth, or you do all things at once. Like it's not like you. It's not three different things. It's one thing, but it's you know, different ways of approaching it.
Yeah, I don't know if you've looked at our group, our YouTube channel. We tend to concentrate on sort of the self-defense side of the English martial arts, as well as doing the classical weapons such as sword and dagger, sword and buckler, quarterstaff, etc. But we try and relate it in a sort of a combat way when we're training.
Yeah, I think that's a very good idea, and it's sort of you have to do that because these arts were meant for actual violence.
Absolutely.
So you have to bring those approaches in, otherwise. Mm. And I've said this before. It's sort of, you know, at some point you have to, if you're serious about HEMA, you have to think about who you are and what these arts were meant to do historically.
Yes, absolutely.
Otherwise, you know, it becomes a very superficial thing.
Yeah.
But I also think that, I've said this as well, but it's like a bit like yoga. You know, there's a spiritual side to yoga that some people just go all in and they embrace all of yoga. And then you have the people who are just, you know, basically it's a stretching thing that they do during lunch hour, and, you know, some fancy gym. And that's both are okay. And maybe you do one thing for a while and then you do the other thing at some other point, but that's, you know, it's all good. But if you're really, really serious, at least you have to reflect the you know, the spiritual aspects of yoga as well, where you stand in that.
Absolutely. So, I mean, for me, my martial arts does involve identity for me, the English martial arts as an Englishman. Does your HEMA hold anything like that for you?
Yeah, it does. I mean, for me, it started with that martial question in a way, right? How can you, like, it's one thing to learn the techniques, but the other one is as also being a nerd. And you know, when I have a self identity inside of me, which is that scrawny little kid who was like 13 years old and wasn't very physical. And obviously, you know, I've tried to change my both my mental preparedness for violence and my physical ability for violence.
Absolutely.
And that also begs the question, like, how do you prepare for violence like this, or how do you prepare for a violent society like these arts were practiced in? And that goes beyond that technical thing of fencing. It's about the reality of violence. And that's a completely different beast than just training techniques, because it's like, and you see this also if you look at videos of people who are in a real violent situation, that, you know, often their preparedness to do violence or their lack of preparedness to do violence is what stops them more than possibly their ability to perform it. You know, it's one thing to punch a punching bag, and it's a good thing to train that, but it's another thing when someone just, you know, walks up to you and is aggressive in a when you're not fully prepared. So I mean, that ties in with self-defense and so on. So for me, I started with that question: how could they do this? How could you pull out a sharp sword and fight with your life at stake.
Yeah.
You know, that fascinated me, that part of the thing. And then that part of the HEMA thing. And then, you know, that also begs the question of what type of culture creates warriors like this?
Yes.
Where does the honor systems play into it? And how do they work? I mean, like, I had a very vague idea of what honor was. Like, I had that idea of it being you know, you open doors for women. That's, yeah. You know, basically like that. It was very mixed of it. What Absolutely. Is chivalry? What is honor? What is, how does that relate to other cultures? And is there a difference? And is there something that we can take out of that today? And how are we different from our ancestors in attitude,
yeah.
as a society, as cultures, and so on?
Yeah.
And the more I thought about it, and the more I try to sort of look into these aspects, it began to evolve as you know, an introspective thing for me, as to grow as a person, and also not as the criticism, but maybe a greater understanding of where we are today as societies, and where we maybe should be, and you know, and it's sort of a balance act, and that's so like it's almost impossible to not offend people when you talk about this, but it's like one of the biggest things of the modern liberal state. It's that we're very focused on our rights as individuals. We're a very individualistic society. We've come very far in the terms of acknowledging that other people are human beings and so on. But traditional societies they're about other things like duties and a lot of more pressure on the individual to be a certain way. And how well you perform in that society sort of dictates your worth. And that is a very that is something that is quite offensive to a lot of modern people, because it goes against what we're taught, like we're all unique and we all have worth and so yeah. on. But, you know, in a way, it's still true. Like the harsh reality is that, you know, we value people who can do things for us.
Yes.
And that's always going to be the case. So it's not necessarily a good thing to tell people that that they have a, you know, value simply by being born and being a person, you know, in your, especially in your formative years, you know, being Absolutely. A parent, you tell kids how to behave, right? But it has to be a balance as well. But a lot of people get very offended when you bring this up, because the historical realities of this was, you know, so very, very different from where we are today.
Absolutely. I mean, it seems to me that it's, people tend to put feelings before facts.
Oh yeah, absolutely. But and also, like, if you Jake Norwood gave me that the book, a Japanese book on the samurai called the Hagakure, written in the 17th century.
Yes, I've read that. Yes,
yeah, it's a fascinating book.
Absolutely.
But one of the things there is that if like the samurai. A samurai would kill himself. He would, you know, do ritual suicide in order to save the face. Not because yes. he did something wrong, but because his master, his lord, did something wrong.
Yes,
and he takes the blame for that. You know, it's the absolute, you know, how do you say, like, the surrender of the individual in favor of the culture and the society that you're in.
Absolutely. Absolutely, yes.
So that's it's a completely different perspective, and it is offensive to people. But I think there's something to learn about it from it. It's not necessarily something that you should replicate in all aspects of modern life. Of course, you know,
not so much now.
No, like it's the absolute disregard of the individual is, of course, like horrendous.
Yeah.
But the other way around is also not true, you know.
No, it's not where good we at never, all.
No, where we never grow up, really, no. or you know, we don't even properly socialize, maybe,
yeah.
because we feel entitled to the world. And
absolutely. And so on. I mean, at our club, I tend to teach something that's called the martial mind, where I try and train the mind as much as I do the body, so that when encounters do occur, if ever, your mind is ready for it. So, I mean, I think in past cultures, the mind was trained as much as the body was, because I mean, you had to have a strong mind behind that will to fight.
It was demanded of you, like it's that Spartan comeback with your shield or on it.
Yes,
like running away is not okay. Like you should die.
Yeah.
Or be victorious.
There's no middle ground.
You should, if you don't die, in, you know, then it's dishonorable.
Absolutely, yes.
So, yeah, and that's also one thing from the Hagakure, like killing yourself, honorably killing yourself in ritual suicide is, that's the next greatest honor. The only bigger one is basically dying in battle. With a sword in hand. So
absolutely, yes. I mean, it's like the soldiers that used to go over the top of the trenches and run into machine gun fire in the First World War.
Yeah, and that was a dishonorable war in many ways.
Yes.
But and it also shows the destructive power of these. Because that's the thing. Like, we have to look for that balance. Like, if you look at honor societies, they vary. Like I've said this before. Like, honor is a currency. That the Romans had a thing that they called dignitas, which it's not dignity. It's more like the weight of a character, where you sort of put in all of the. Your rank in society, your social class, your behavior, everything, like, into that sort of term of dignitas. So that becomes your sort of currency, and honor as a currency is, what gives you that, the value of that. That sort of changes, but if you look at almost like all of the societies I've looked at, it sort of describes at the very core level the basics. It's worked the same way. It's a currency, but that you can sort of it gives you if you have more value to your currency, it gives you benefits in that society.
Yes,
but the price you pay is often harsh and so on. But and in some societies the downside of it is just immense, and you have those societies today as well, where like if a woman is raped, she has to die for the honor of your family. You know, like that's just a horrendous aspect.
It's ridiculous.
Of some of these. It is right. So and the World War One, where you people killing each other for. For just political, it's a political game that ends in millions being killed and so on. So it can really be abused as well, but it's a balance because as I said, the other version isn't so good as well.
No, absolutely. I mean, two extremes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's always the middle ground, isn't it?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I've noticed this a lot in sort of HEMA, not so much in Western martial arts and living traditions, but in the sort of HEMA over the last 15, 20 years. Like, how do you feel about the identity politics within HEMA? Now, you don't have to answer this one.
That's a minefield.
Isn't it? It really is. I mean, I've tried to explain myself in how I feel about it over the years, and I always sort of get lots of hate for it. But I think it's quite important to call out what you see.
Yeah, sure. No, I agree with that. I've tried to separate politics and HEMA. I think it's important that we're unpolitical, and I've always been very, clear about that. HEMA should be open to anyone and share. And I've one of my first experiences in HEMA was. an event that Dave Rawlings hosted where, where there were Gatka people there and how they shared their martial heritage with us and so on. But, you know, there's also that aspect of you don't join the Gatka crowd and just, you know, implement your – try to enforce your sort of way of looking at what they should be doing. Like, no. You have to be respectful. It goes both ways.
Absolutely. Right?
So I think that's one of the things. It's become so infected in HEMA that people aren't really rational about it.
No.
And I see there's a little crowd, and I think unfortunately, like there are a few in Sweden. Seems to be quite a lot in the UK.
Oh yes.
And there's also. It's a big country, so that's no wonder, but there are quite a few in the US as well, where of these people who are quite authoritarian in their outlook on people, and they try to shut down people who describe the world differently to how they describe it. They claim this has to do with, you know, that these differing opinions, like anything that is different from their opinion is dangerous for... You know, for some reason, that's really not the case. They might believe it in themselves, but then they don't understand their own psychology. I think it's the actual reason is that they fear that their own worldview will crumble when it's challenged with other truths.
Absolutely,
ideas that they believe in. Yeah. So,
I mean, I think a lot of it comes from universities. Myself.
Yeah, that might be it. And, just a general sort of society, it's splitting society in Western society, at least. Anyways, I hope we can overcome it.
I'm sure we will. I mean, we just recently in London had what was, I think it was called a day of freedom, where they had a massive rally for freedom of speech. About 40,000 people turned up. But no news medias gave any information out, reported on it at all. Yeah. It was mad. So it seems that freedom of speech, for some reason, is the enemy of I don't know, whatever. It's just a really strange thing that people didn't report on it.
That's really weird.
Isn't it?
I haven't heard about this.
No.
Which isn't strange then. But, And that's also been like in society in general, like freedom of speech is like you shouldn't have that because you need to protect the feelings, you know.
Yeah.
You know, your feelings are hurting my thinking. You know, I don't really care that much, but I think that we should be able to
express ourselves. We should.
Yeah, and it's better if someone says something that's offensive, you know.
Yeah.
That's fine. Like you either deal with your feelings of that being offensive or you take the argument and you, but like just shutting it down, does anyone seriously believe that that will actually work? I don't,
I think they do actually think that will work. I mean, I don't understand it because I mean, my feelings get hurt. Nothing happens to me.
No.
I just get over it. The same as everyone. So I don't see the point in that.
That's about being an adult, right?
Yeah, of course it is. I mean, how do you ever expect to bring your children up properly if you don't know how to think right yourself?
Yeah, exactly. Like you have to be able to like that's one of the greatest achievements of mankind. That's how you actually progress. Like if you're being a progressive, that's how you progress by accepting that other people have different outlooks on life and that you cannot know everything, that you cannot have all of the knowledge, that you are imperfect as a human and that you can get better, you can gain knowledge by exposing yourself to other people.
Absolutely.
In the same time, we started talking about, like I've been starting to shut people out of my Facebook feed and stuff.
Because yes.
There's a difference between people who are just like, they're like a record that's broken. Like they're just repeating the same messages and sending out links and being hateful against anyone who challenges. Like, that's not very constructive. Like,
no, it's not very helpful.
No, so that's what we're doing now, like sitting here and talking. I'm talking to other people, like on all, you know, if you look at them politically, they're from like extreme leftists,
yeah,
but like fairly rational.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah, actually, I know. Yeah, so,
I've never met one.
So do I shout out now and name them? I don't think so.
Maybe. No.
Well, you know, there are people who are like have different perspectives than me that I talk to very regularly, like every day almost, as often as I can. But they don't get offended, or they can at least handle, you know, when they get offended, and they don't get.
See, I mean, I don't understand why people would lose friends over differences in politics. I mean, surely people can be rational and kind and discuss things nicely between each other, rather than having to get to a state where they no longer sort of they get into hating each other just because of politics.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are two coins of it. There are the people who are they get angry and they can't handle it, and they're just immature. And then there's a little clique of people who are, it is what you said. It's a political method that they're using to shut things down. And,
yeah.
And unfortunately, like in HEMA, maybe that's not the people who are very like the best fencers. Maybe like they can get their sort of position from just claiming the right worldview according to them. Get their little followers and so on.
Absolutely, they get their little group of followers who worship them.
Yeah, so that's a very dangerous thing. That's what I mean when I say that we should keep politics out of it.
Like yeah,
it doesn't matter your race, your sexuality, your political views. That shouldn't matter. As soon as you step in through the doors, like you're all welcome, and you treat each other like fencers. You shake hands, you salute, you're polite. You there's a limit to how you act. Like there, you don't go too far. If there's all of that.
I mean, I always tell everybody who joins my club, you leave your ego at the door and you pick it up on the way out.
Yeah.
Because there's no room in the gym for egomaniacs, political nutters, anything like that.
Yeah.
You've just got to come in, be who you are, train, and then leave. And then pick up who the person you were. Because in a training gym, that kind of thing can be dangerous.
Yeah,
you know it can be dangerous, especially people with big egos.
Yeah, really, and that's like if you're not even if you can't handle people who have a different opinion than you on certain regards, how will you handle that when your ego takes a turn in fencing? Will you still like would you be able to control your emotions?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, what makes me laugh is, I mean, as humankind, civilization, we've cut ourselves off from nature a bit.
Yeah.
And if we were to go out into nature, we wouldn't last 5 minutes the way we are now. I mean, you get certain kinds of people who live in countries who really do live with nature. You know, they're among it all the time, so they know how to survive and how to do things. But when you actually put, say, a westernized, civilized person out into nature, you know, put them in the middle of a forest or a jungle, and they wouldn't really survive for very long because they have no survival skills in that way. So all politics then goes out the window. You'd have to rely on each other to survive. Yeah. And I think that's how society should be, where we rely on each other to survive and get through things, rather than have all these massive political divides all the time.
Yeah, Absolutely. And like, if you want to grow into, like, we grow through adversity in some respects, right? Mm. Growing up is facing adversity, you know, going from child to an adult.
Yes.
That's you know, facing the challenges that are thrown in front of you, and you know.
I think you've got that horrible bit in between being a child and being an adult. You've got those teenage years.
Yeah.
worst time.
You're growing so much. You're constantly tired.
Yeah.
You don't want any more adversity. Just
absolutely
getting taller and you can't speak properly. And
getting spotty.
Yeah, exactly. But like intellectually, like different opinions, that's the adversity that you have to face, right?
Yeah.
And physically, you get better at physically by physical adversity, and mentally, you get stronger if you overcome, you know, mental adversity. So these things are very important aspects to consider when you're doing. I think if you're not willing to face those things, well, you know, you could just do it as pastime and it's a fun thing, but
you're
still going to be, you know, you're not going to go the full length.
So, Anders, like every other HEMA person, do you collect swords?
I don't.
You don't?
I don't really collect swords. No, I don't. I have a few swords, of course.
How many?
I don't know. My fiance said, "Well, you're not buying a sword, are you? Because you already have too many." I was like, "I don't. Maybe I have five. Five swords." And I went into the wardrobe where I keep my swords. Like maybe there were 20. So I don't consider that collecting swords.
Yeah.
Far worse collectors out there. And most of them are like fitters.
Of course. So in your HEMA room, Anders, do you ever practice different kinds of weapons, or are you just a two-hand sword man?
I do practice a few. I've started doing more rapier and dagger, and that's where also I began with that group Shudasal that I spoke about. Shudasal. I don't remember exactly, but we did rapier and dagger, and I've also done a little bit of sword and buckler back in the day, and you know, and a little bit of wrestling. And but like, I always come back to the longsword. That's my
your main thing. Yeah, I mean, that is a massive scene, really, within HEMA, isn't it? The two-hand sword or the long sword. Do you do the Montante?
I don't.
No, that's a very long sword.
yeah, it is. I've read the sources, and I've tried some of the drills out and stuff like that, but I can't really say that I've trained it.
Do you like it?
It's a very big sword.
Yeah, isn't it? Yeah.
I like it. I mean, like, I'm fascinated by all things, and like, humor-wise, I think, you know, there's something to get out of anything from the Montante to the small sword, or unarmed even. You know, it all teaches you things. I mean, you can see how they're related. They're just like the focus changes. And there's something, like, you know.
Absolutely. Well, Anders, that was really good. I loved that. That was a terrific interview. And I'm going to have to end it here.
Yeah.
And thank you very much. And hopefully one day we could meet up and maybe do some training together.
Yeah, I'd love that. Like,
that would be absolutely terrific.
This was the first time we really spoke, wasn't it?
Well,
we haven't really, like, when you contacted me, I think that was the first time we ever wrote each other. Yeah.
It was, yeah.
Great to make your acquaintance.
And you, Anders. I'll tell you what, it was really, really good to meet people who are like-minded.
Yeah, it is. All right.
So okay, then. Thank you very much, and hopefully we'll speak soon.
Listen to us, because we listen to you.